Welcome to Unscripted Study, the podcast where thoughtful conversation meets the pages of the Bible. I'm your host, Benjamin Rollins, and I'm here with Harrison Cohn and Benjamin Battles, and we're excited to continue on this journey of exploration and dialogue with you. Here on Unscripted Study, we dive into the ancient wisdom of the Bible, unravel ethical quandaries, and dissect societal issues, all in a candid, unscripted manner. In each episode, we'll be exploring the timeless teachings of the Bible and connecting them to the complexities of our modern world. No scripts, no filters, just genuine conversation that invite you to ponder, reflect, and maybe even challenge your perspectives. And the best part, we meet twice a month, giving you ample time to reflect on each episode, maybe even gather your own thoughts and join the conversation. So mark your calendars, subscribe, and get ready to continue on our bi-monthly rendezvous with Unscripted Study. Well, good evening or good morning or good afternoon, whenever you are listening to this. We're glad to be back here with you. We had a week delay from, we were supposed to have a session last week, but we are here to continue our study of Judges. We're going to be looking at, in particular, chapters 10 through 13. And we have the full crew with us today, Harrison and Ben. And so glad that we're all at full capacity here.
Yeah, glad to be back.
So to begin, I'm just going to kind of briefly recap. So the previous session, we were dealing with, and I'm blanking on the name. Harrison, remind me of the judge we were dealing with last time.
It was the
main one, Gideon, right?
Was it Gideon?
I think it was Gideon and...
Yeah, Gideon and his son, Abimelech.
Yes, thank you. Gideon and his son, Abimelech. Thank you. Yeah, and so we were dealing with that story. And so this one we're going to pick up after Abimelech, and it's going to go into some other judges. So particularly in chapter 10, just for everyone's kind of foundational knowledge, chapter 10 is dealing with Tola and Jair, which rule after Abimelech. And then after each of these judges die, the Israelites turn to wickedness, worshiping false gods.
Shocker.
Yep, shocker. This is a book of Judges right there. Ultimately, they're oppressed by a foreign group, the Ammonites, and so they elect another judge, Jephthah, I think is how it's pronounced. And the rest of this deals with Jephthah basically fighting against the Ammonites who have been oppressing Israel. And then through chapter 12, that story continues. When they agree to appoint him as a judge. And then 13 is the story of Samson, his birth, and kind of the blessing that the Lord has put upon him. All right. In particular, I wanted to just kind of begin with, as I was reading chapter 10, I kind of accidentally kind of got into some number study, not so much like Bible code, nothing that cryptic, but I was just kind of looking at, after Abimelech, there were the judges, and I've got to take a call. Can you guys begin? I'll be right back. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
What I think is really interesting about Judges that's important to remember is that it's a book of history, right? And the thing that's what gets me about history is, like, up to this point, up to 10, you kind of have like And then there was so-and-so and he judged Israel. And then there was so-and-so and he judged Israel. And then there was so-and-so and he judged Israel. And then there was Shamgar, the greatest of all the judges. And then you had so-and-so and he judged Israel and whatnot. But you kind of around this point start diving into more of a events-based history instead of a person-based history. You know, because it you get Samson. It's more about Samson's life and the events of Samson's life, and I think we start to less follow, kind of. And then rose up and he judged, and then he rose up and he judged, and then he rose up and he judged, and it becomes more of like this is the crap Israel was doing,
yes.
And this is the crap that they were dealing with, and it kind of comes around because we don't have that much more. Judges is not a long book, you know, but you get about halfway through, and you're like. I know we're not talking about some of these stuff, but Samson is like six chapters.
Yeah,
it's by far one of like the largest section of Judges that focuses on one judge, and really from here down, like you have like this righteous judge in Deborah. You have other righteous judges, these like Ehud, who is a righteous judge, like, yeah. And then you just. With Gideon's son, it just starts to like go downhill.
Yeah.
Like we'll see in this section, like men making promises or vows they shouldn't have made. Samson like sleeping around with Philistine women, like all sorts of wild stuff. And it's just important to when we're looking at the book of Judges that we don't look to the book of Judges as instruction on how to be.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, we don't need to look at Samson's life and be like, I need to be like Samson.
Yeah,
you should look at Samson's life and like glean why is this in the Bible?
Yeah,
what's important for me to learn? Why are these invent? Why did the Hebrews record this specifically of all the people? Samson kills it's either 800 or 1200. I can't remember. We'll get there with the jawbone of a donkey. He kills hundreds of men with the jawbone of a donkey. Shamgar kills hundreds of men with an ox goat. Why is Samson's story? Six chapters and ox scars and Shamgar's one sentence.
Yeah.
And what's the significance there? And I don't necessarily know, but that's the kind of stuff we need to wrestle with when working through the book of Judges, not things like I need to be like Samson. I need to find me a Philistine woman and like go against not honor my parents. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. I need to go burn fields by tying torches to the tails of a fox. Like,
right.
We get into the habit, and this is one of the things that I've kind of preached this whole time we've been doing this podcast, of like, and especially people, and I believe it's people who've not actually read the Bible cover to cover in context, they hold it up and they say, this is everything you need.
Yeah.
This has everything you need. Like, this is your roadmap to life. Like, it's not a roadmap to life. It's not. That's not what the Bible is. That's the wrong question. The Bible's not going to tell you what to do at what turn. The Bible's not going to tell you, like...
If I may... I think it's accurate to say the Bible is not a roadmap to your life. Maybe in the biggest abstract sense of like, what is life? What are the deepest questions in the world? What is, you know,
inherent
longing of being human? You're going to find the most nuanced and poetic answers, you know, in the Bible. But as for like, what does Harrison or Ben or Ben do tomorrow? Yeah. Good luck, man.
And, you know, it's 2024, so election year. It's going to be a crazy year. And so if you're like, I'm going to go to the Bible to decide who to vote for.
Right.
Like, you look, both people running are snakes.
Yeah.
Like, they're not righteous people, no matter what way you slice it or dice it. And that, yeah, sure, we'll favor one over the other, but not looking at judges specifically, or kings is another one where like you have all these horrible wicked kings, same thing in the Chronicles, and look at them like, who should I exemplify, like who should I be like? And really we only see that once in the whole Bible, which is with Paul. And Paul's like, be imitators of me. And so really when we look at the Bible and when we look at
Judges, even then, important caveat, he says be imitators of me as I imitate
Christ,
which is almost implicit of like, if you catch me slipping, either hold me accountable or stop listening.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. And so engage with the text in the Old Testament because Old Testament's the majority of the Bible. It's super important, but engage with it as like, how does this help me understand my relationship with God and God's relationship with me and God's relationship with all of humanity? Why is that important? So then we get into to Tola and Jair or Jair, or I'm not Hebrew of the time, yeah. So who knows? But basically, after the son of Gideon, Abimelech, dies, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. We don't know anything about him. He just judged Israel 23 years. And it's important to note that the Hebrew word here used also is kind of interchangeably used with ruler. So it's not just like, because we get the English word judges from the Hebrew word. I think it's shafat. Let me look it up real quick. Hebrew word for judges. But shofet. I was close. It's close. I'll take it.
Close enough.
Shofet. And so it, we need to understand that this word is closer to those that ruled.
Yeah.
So it's not that they're kings, but it's these people. Like when Moses says, set judges over you, set decision makers over you, set people to instruct you and rule over you and make sure you're not doing bad things. And so that's what is happening here is you just, there's something notable about Tola's life that's important for us to know that for 23 years, he judged Israel. Yeah. He was the one that people went to get their clarity. And after him was Jair. He also was over 20 years. He had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities, which basically just means he was rich. That's what that's like. This was a rich judge, and things were good under him.
Yeah, I definitely wonder about the literal, probably more in Judges than any other book, I wonder about the literal nature of the numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, like, was it really 600 men who Shamgar killed, or was it
yes.
sets of lots of men?
It was 600 sets of 100.
Right. Or it like was, with 30 sons or 40 sons, you know, yeah. Is this, you know, a poetic way to say like he had a lot of people yeah. who answered him or looked up to him, you know, are they son-in-laws? Are they servants? You know, whatever. Unclear, but you know, like you said, it does, it speaks to that he was rich and Shamgar was strong.
Right. Shamgar, we always must read Shamgar literally, though. That is the only...
Him specifically. The rest of him,
like, that's just good interpretation. The ones you like, you read literally. The ones you don't like, you read metaphorically. And that's how you should interpret
them. Yeah, that's exactly... That is the best hermeneutic for...
Asterisk, heavy sarcasm.
Yeah.
But basically, I guess then we move into this larger disobedience and oppression that happens after Jair dies. And it's basically what we've seen before is they turn after the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria. And I think if I'm not mistaken, we actually get a larger point. It's like the first time we see the other gods more than just Baal and the Ashtaroth. Is that something you guys can confirm? It's not just... They lusted after the Baals and the Ashtaroths, but they lusted after the gods of Syria and the gods of Sidon and the gods of Moab and the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. It's like a greater degree than we've seen previously, which is kind of wild to think about. Ben, I know you were talking about kind of numbers, getting into numbers.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you want to, we had touched on Jair and Tola, just that Jair was rich and how to interpret well, but I wanted to give you that point to talk about the numbers that you did.
No, I appreciate that very much. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, this is that which is nice because this whole number thing was specifically with this section, the Tola and Jair section. So interestingly, I was reading through it. So it says in particular. At the very beginning, chapter 10, after Abimelech, Tola became judge, He did 23 years and then Jair, and he did 22 years. And so what's interesting to me is for both of them, that's 45 years. And then after that is when, in verse 6, as you guys were mentioning, this egregious idolatry begins to take place.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, okay, 45 years. And I was trying to think, is there some kind of significance to that? And I came across something interesting. So in 2 Chronicles, there's a basin that is described. It's a huge basin that was constructed during Solomon's time. And it was essentially a place for people to go and bathe and to get washed. So there was essentially a giant basin. And then below that, there were rings around it that were filled with water from this larger basin that was at the higher elevation. So again, this is a very large structure. And it was described as being 30 cubits in circumference or 45 feet. And so I just began to kind of meditate on that. And I came across this other verse in Ezekiel where he has this vision where he's transported and there's this water that's flowing from a certain gate and everything planted along either side of it is flourishing. There's fruit, there's provision, and there's life. And so that basin in 2 Chronicles and that water idea from Ezekiel, this basin was actually called the basin or the molten sea. And particularly this basin was mostly used by priests of Israel who would then wash themselves in order to carry on with different services and different religious functions. Then both Caleb and Joshua were kept alive for 45 years so that they could enter the promised land, which was a declaration given to them by the Lord for their faithfulness. And Abraham asked the Lord during his intercession over Sodom that if there were just 45 righteous, would he spare Sodom? And the Lord, of course, replied yes. And so I begin to kind of piece this all together, right? It's a lot of different numbers. Again, I wasn't trying to pursue some Bible code. I wasn't trying to unlock some some sort of Gnostic truth.
Many years until the end times.
Right. Yeah. That was not my goal. I was just following the numbers. I was just kind of following the wind of the spirit in a sense. And I kind of came to this moment. This was my question. And I can ask it to y'all as well. Are these connected? Entering promise, interceding with the Lord as Abraham did, idolatry in this basin. This huge basin, a threshold moment after 45 years presented itself. Is there something significant just generally about that kind of year? Because again, we have certain festivals in Israel which were designated to fall on certain years. So there's definitely intentionality when the Lord is when he's constructing sort of our reality in terms of its length. And then lastly, had the Israelites bailed on the promise, ceased to get to know their Lord and ignored the basin. And then this is what led to idolatry, not necessarily the physical basin, but this idea that they were not washing themselves, so to say, of what they needed to be washed of in kind of this spiritual sense. And that if we think back to earlier in Judges, the Lord said, I want these Israelites to fight so they learn how to do battle. And so I wonder if this, after 45 years, this was a, will they continue? Will they do what is right? And yet, unfortunately, they don't. And so to me, not only is the river perhaps indicative of, you could say of obedience, you could say of loyalty, of fidelity, of God's justice, right? All of these ideas. But yet at its core was this ritual habitual washing the result of peace under Tola and Jair, that just like we talked about last time, the cycle of man, how it's easy to come to the Lord in crisis, but when we're blessed and when we're thriving, it's much harder to be as intentional and as devout as we are in seasons of difficulty. And to kind of put a pin in all of this, there's this verse in Habakkuk. I think it was in Habakkuk 1. He's talking about, the Lord's talking about the Chaldeans. And he says, their justice and sovereignty stemmed from themselves, as an accusation, that their own perception is what has caused them to be a cruel people and immoral people. And for Israel, that lack of washing, I wonder if that is what, in some sense, fueled this sense of self-justice and self-sovereignty that we see, in particular here in Judges 10.
What was the reference again for the washing?
Yes, so in 2 Chronicles, I'll give you the 2 Chronicles 4, it talks about this basin. Mm-hmm. And then Ezekiel 47:12 is this vision he has of the river and life, fruit, provision on either bank. And then that one is in Habakkuk 1. He's talking about the Chaldeans. So again, I know that was a lot of kind of expansive information. It was kind of boundaryless. But as I was walking through that, I just kept going back to that basin. I kept going back to the water. I kept going back to this maybe this threshold moment after Tola and Jair. And if there's any connective tissue. I'm interested to hear what you guys think of all that. I know that's a lot.
Yeah, I think that we were coming on to that a little bit, that this was, it's kind of the start of the bad judges, you know, like, mm-hmm. Tola and Jair are the last judges, like, that you could say God rose up, because
something like that.
He's actually not ordained by God as a judge. The people choose him.
Right.
Right. It's like, hey, come lead over us. And he's, yep, he's also an outcast. Yep. And he also does bad things. And Samson does bad things. And so we kind of just start to see this spiraling. And, you know, we know that all of this was not written in real time. It wasn't like, okay, then the writer's like, I'll take a break after Jair and we'll see who comes around. Oh, okay, it's Japheth. Let me pick back up the story. It's like, this is written later. And so I think it's interesting that the last judge, Jair, they talk about his sons. Because we know that Japheth is childless. Well, not the beginning, but he ends childless. And then you have later, there's a judge with like 70 sons, I think, you know, I mean, like, and so there's this almost like talking about, is there a removal? Is there like a step back? It's almost like after Jair, this disobedience and oppression that Israel undergoes is much greater than before. It's like a pivot point in Judges that even the men, like Israel is not repentant enough. And like, and as we go down to 10, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord saying, we have sinned against you because we have forsaken our God and served the Baals. And then the Lord said to the people, did I not save you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites and from the Ammonites and from the Philistines? The Sidians also and the Amalekites and the Maonites oppressed you, and you cried out to me and I saved you. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will save you no more. Like right there, that's a pivot point. Go and cry out to the gods whom you have chosen. Let them save you in the time of your distress. But the people double down. And they say, please deliver us. Only you can deliver us. And they even put away the foreign gods among them, and they served the Lord, and he became impatient over the misery of Israel. We don't know what the time frame is there, right? And does anyone else have any other translations? I know I'm running off the ESV, but became impatient over the misery of Israel. Anyone have anything else that they say there?
Can you say the verse again?
Yeah, it's 10:16. So when they put away, 10:16, so they, yes. Yeah, so they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord, and he became impatient over their misery. That just makes me see that kind of talking about earlier, I think before we started recording, is like God's capacity to change his mind. Yeah. So that's how I read that, is this great mercy.
Yeah. The NIV says he could bear it no longer. Yeah.
And the Christian standard says weary.
Yeah.
And the complete Jewish Bible says he was troubled by their misery.
Mm. Yeah. But then we have battle. And the people and leaders of Gilead, who is the man that shall fight against us that it behead? And then we get into Jephthah, was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a prostitute. I don't know that that is, it's important enough to be written here, but I don't know that it's important enough for us to dwell on it. There's plenty of, other reasons there. But the thing that you're talking about here, Ben, is like there is a catalyst moment after this 45 years of like major disobedience, so much so that God's first inclination is like, yeah, I may not destroy you, but like go ask the other gods for help.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's key. Is that connected to the basin that you were talking about in Chronicles? Is that connected to the 45 years of Caleb and Joshua? Is that, I don't know. It's all very interesting. Numbers are interesting. It's not something that I've ever like zoned in on in the Bible, but I don't deny that there may be some connection in the mysteries that we've talked about before.
Yeah. I think we were talking about this before we started recording, but I've been listening to a lot of the Bible Project lately, their podcast, and something that I think I appreciate a lot about the way that they exposit the text is talking about how often phrases are word for word repetitions in the Hebrew in the Old Testament, that there are moments that are very clear call outs of like, we said this before, and it created a pattern. It created a symbol of sorts that we can call back to and say, just like in chapter one, now, just like in chapter two, now, just like in chapter, that it like the Bible layers, creates its own sort of like codex of meaning that continuously layers on top of itself. If you wanted to pull that thread on like, the significance of 45, like specifically in this text, I would think you would really have to like either A, pray about it, or B, like lean into more rabbinic literature, like the things that are not necessarily canon Old Testament, but like the Midrash and that sort of stuff. Like how did the rabbis interpret it at the time? Yeah. And there may be, I think, if I can like jump backwards a little bit, because I know this is my first episode to talk about Judges. Like, I think this is a book that I, growing up, I feel like I've had a complex relationship with, because as a kid, you just know Samson, right? That's like the only one that gets told is the story of Samson. And he's obviously a complex character. Like Harrison was talking about while you were stepped away, Ben, like he's not necessarily a model of perfect behavior.
Tempestuous.
Yeah. He's, gosh, I can't think what the word is. Like a cautionary tale in a lot of ways, right? So, like, that's clear. But still, there's that aspect of, like, but he was super strong, right? Like, and so when I was, like, old enough to read the Bible for myself and I read Judges on my own, there's definitely this action hero component of it in the back of my mind of, like, these are the heroes. These are the champions. These guys are amazing. Was there some messed up stuff in there? Yeah, you just kind of like gloss over it and go, it was a tough time, and as I got older and more mature, it was a harder book for me to like take as like, well, what is the meaning? Like, why do we have this? Like, why are these the heroes of the Old Testament? And I think something that I took, I cannot think of the professor's name now, but in college, I took class on Old Testament, counted as a history class, which was nice. Appreciate that.
They offered that.
There was one class. There was one class in the religion department for Old Testament, And technically, it did not count towards my transcript, but I talked to my advisor about it, and he was like, well, I'm not going to make you do double work. That's a 2000 level history. Knocked it out, you know? Like,
right on.
So I was like, okay, great. But anyways, he pointed out, I think Lamsma, I think was his.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, yes, yeah. I just came. He pointed out that talking about numbers specifically, that when you look at the reign of the judges, it gets, like, if you were to put it on a graph, it gets continuously shorter as the book goes on. Their reigns of peace continuously shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's these times when they're dominated by their enemies, by the Philistines or whoever, and those reigns of occupation or oppression get continuously bigger as the book goes on. And they use this refrain, again, that like layered meaning of like, they're, it's not an accident. They use this refrain over and over again. And again, the people did what was right in their own eyes. And that becomes the use of that phrase becomes more frequent as the book goes on. And that's like the ultimate punchline of Judges. But hey, this is kind of, I think, what you were building to, Harrison, that like there is a degradation as we get further away from Moses, that they are not trustworthy with the law. They don't hold to it, even when they've seen the consequences. As they get further and further away from that, like, inciting incident, it's easier to turn away. It's easier to muddle our gods in with others. And so those numbers are not, I don't know how clear each of those numbers is. It's like, is every number in the book a call out to some specific meaning or some specific reference in the bigger story of God? Unclear. But as Judges is a singular book, it is not an accident that the times of peace get shorter and the times of oppression get larger. You know?
Yeah.
I think to me, that really helped me. This is kind of the conversation Harrison and I were having while you were on the call, but that I think that really like opened my eyes to how do you interpret what's happening in the book of Judges, which is that people were not doing what they were supposed to do. Even the heroes, right? Like that's, I think that's the big punchline, is that even the people who were saving Israel and protecting the legacy of the nation were not righteous.
No.
And God was willing to use the worst people to continue his, you know, to continue his purposes. But they called themselves righteous, you know?
Yeah. Well, that makes me like, because then when we get down to Jephthah, Jephthah, thanks. We went to Hawaii once, my wife and I, and she had to pronounce all the names because, like, I just like hooked on phonics, like, just didn't work for me or something. And so all those Hawaiian names, I just couldn't. Everything was like Enohai, and I was like, no, that, there's no N in that word. Anyway, Jephthah. And so this goes to what you're saying goes to earlier about God's compromising. You know, when God's like, yeah, who were we talking about?
I think it was pre-recording, but we were talking
about David.
Yeah, David wanting to build the temple. Say this is God's idea, and God. And then we talked about Abraham, changing that mind of God. Moses changing the mind of God, and that's a larger theological discussion of are they actually changing the mind of God, or is it God like knowing they're going to do it anyway?
Yeah.
But it's almost like God's like, oh, okay, you chose Jephthah. All right.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't even use the term like raised up.
Yeah.
I believe like the other judges, it's just, they chose him.
Yeah.
What is it? Where is it? Like, and the people said to Jephthah, come and be our leader that we may fight against the Amorites. And then it gets like, did you not hate me? Did you not like, why should I lead you? It becomes this squabble between men as opposed to like a Gideon story or a Deborah story or something like that.
And I think even that, I think that speaks ill of Israel at the time, that their hero is someone, their hero in this moment is someone that they had despised and rejected.
Yep.
Right? Like, this is what we're left with, is that we have to, and even I don't know how much Jephthah deserves the hate that he gets, but this is the state of the nation at this time, is that like, in order to save ourselves, we have to eat humble pie and go talk to this person that we despise. So either he doesn't deserve it, and the majority of the country is bullies focused on image or whatever, or he does deserve it, and you know, our strongest warrior is a hooligan, right? So like, either way, like, it's a lose-lose interpretation, you know? And yeah, I don't think that's an accident.
And to me, what's interesting is, as I was reading about, I love the kind of the dichotomy of that, Ben. And in particular with Jephthah, is to me, what I saw with Jephthah and I see with Samson so clearly is they were prototypes of Jesus
in their actions.
And particularly when we briefly talk about Samson, there's a very powerful verse, but even in Jephthah, he was born of unusual means, just like Jesus was. He traveled with some who were considered unworthy, right? These disciples that he called, people were asking, why do you call them? Jephthah tried to negotiate with the enemy, whereas Jesus did not. And so I think this is where we see kind of because the quality of the judges had fallen, so had the quality of their ministry or their working on the earth. Whereas Jesus didn't negotiate with the enemy. There was no compromise. It was, you're coming out, you're being rebuked, you're being attacked. And yet, with Jephthah, as heartbreaking as it is, that he makes a reckless vow that he will sacrifice the first person that comes out of his home, which happens to be his daughter, and then he sacrifices her. After a great victory, we see a problematic, questionable, unclear vow. And yet, what does Jesus do when he conquers the enemy? He gives himself up.
Yeah.
And just what a beautiful image, right? Yeah. That Jephthah, this judge that they had summoned, they had anointed as leader to go fight against their enemies, he gets this victory and he sacrifices a human, his daughter. Yeah. Jesus, in even more, a spiritual victory, we'll say. And he does it by sacrificing himself. And so as I was reading through that, I just kept seeing parallels to Jesus, and how you can kind of see, if this makes sense, you can kind of see the seeds of what the Lord was going to do at the crucifixion in Jephthah, yeah. Right? You see the idea of sacrifice. You see the idea of dealing with the enemy, right? Yeah. Negotiation versus conquest. And just to add this on briefly, to me, for Israel, who turned away from the Lord, who the quality of the judges declined, the periods of oppression increased, I just think back to Moses, right? After Moses, it started falling. What does it say? The people of Israel were acquainted with the acts of God, but Moses was acquainted with the ways of God.
Yeah.
In that, there's something powerful about looking past a miracle and saying, I want to get to know the one who made that happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of one of the components of Israel's fall, particularly in Judges, is they see the miracle and then that's where it stops. There's no, I want to get to know the one who did that. It's just, thank you for the miracle, next.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's hard to push past that because the breakthrough is powerful, right? But then to say, that's great, but there's something better.
I think I hadn't really thought about this before, but when there's the transition from Moses to Joshua, there's this concern of like, will you know, Moses was a miracle worker. Like, we had to follow Moses. Will they still follow Joshua? And in his like inauguration, basically in Joshua 1, there's this phrase where they say, like, we will follow you. And now I'm gonna have to look it up. They basically say, like, we will follow you only as long as you follow God. That there's this like confession that, like, no, like, what, Joshua, like, we're cool with you. Let me just look it up real quick. Da-da-da. So it's the end of Joshua 1. They say, whatever you've commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Mm. So they say, like, we will follow you only if God is with you in the same way that he was with Moses, which I think could be interpreted, you know, one way to, like, what you were saying, Ben, that they, like, are really just in it for, like, the miracles of, like, look, we almost got squashed and the sea just opened up. That was crazy. Like, Joshua, if you can do that, like, we're with you. But I think also, like, there's this heart of, like, we were in the wilderness for 40 years because of our own mistakes. In this moment, at this particular intersection, they really are, like, they have, like, fasted away their reliance on other gods. They're like, they're mingling with other cultures. A whole generation has lived and died in the desert. It's people who have only known manna and, you know, the provision of God. And they're saying, look, this is it. This is the only way. Joshua, we will go with you only if God also goes with you. And that is not the way that they talk throughout the book of Judges. Mm-hmm. You know, they are like, we will, for instance, in this moment, right? In this moment, there is no conversation about God when they appoint Jephthah as leader. It's like, we will go with you if you will kick their butts. That's the conversation, right? It's like, this guy seems tough and we need someone who's tough. Righteous, I don't know, I don't care either. Like, we will go with you as long as you are strong. It's almost, you know, that there's the refrain in Joshua 1 of be strong and courageous as Joshua's command. There's almost like a perversion of that here of, yeah, like, it's not so much, we're not looking for someone who's courageous. We're looking for someone who is violent, you know, who is,
you're right.
You know, we're looking for someone who is brutal. That's what we need. Cause we just got to tip some people.
Yeah.
And that is just so different. It's just such a different, art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's, mm-hmm. That's fascinating. No. Yeah. Yeah.
I agree, and I think there's more here to Jephthah when we come to his vow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the really interesting thing about, and the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. So it's, you know, even it admits that, like, God uses Jephthah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where is that reference? Can you call that out?
In verse 29. Of 11.
Okay,
11:29. It says, then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and passed through Mizpah and Gilead, and he passed through, you know, passed on to the Ammonites. And then this is when he makes his vow, and which was a wrong vow.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Levitical law, like, it was not a vow that he would have had to,
right,
follow through with, because it was a sinful vow. And, like, under the law, like, you don't have to keep a vow that is sinful, being that human sacrifice is abominable. What else is going to come out of the door of your house?
Yeah, exactly.
Which, yeah, you know, I can't think of any, like, clear references off the top of my head, but I feel like I've heard expositions of this text before that explain that that was a custom of the surrounding cultures. This is the way that you know, Jephthah, a wild man, a foreigner who, you know, like, foreigner in the sense that he's, like, not, he's, like, living on the outskirts of Israel, clearly not practicing in any way. All he knows about God is that gods are angry and they need sacrifices, right? Like, this is the way our neighbors do it. This is what gods want. So he feels some type of way. He feels, you know, blessed, I guess, to be chosen. And so he's like, well, I guess I gotta act like a chosen one. This is what a chosen one does. It just shows how little they know about their God at this point. They don't really know him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just because, and it's, that's evidenced by, I cannot take back my vow.
Yeah.
Like, had you known the law, like what Ben the Greater, I'm just, Ben Rollins was talking about a minute ago. You know, had they known the law, he would have known, one, not to make that, but also, like, oops, I made that. It's okay for me to, like, repent and not do that, because that's not who my God is.
Mm-hmm.
But then I find it interesting, the, like, Jephthah's the next major judge after Gideon. Right? I mean, yes. Maybe if you want to call Abimelech a major judge, I guess we could. But you know, he's not a minor judge like Shamgar or Tola or Jer. Like we don't know what they did. And I think it's interesting that what does Ephraim have against these judges? Like, why do we see this repeat with Ephraim next when they're like, you didn't call us to go up and fight. We're going to kill you. Like that's what happened with Gideon.
Oh, you're right. Ooh, good callback.
It's the exact same thing. Literally the exact same story, but it's two generations later. You know, maybe one generation later, a generation and a half. It's at least 45 plus years later.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's not counting for the time when that happened during Gideon's rule and Abimelech and Abimelech's time, and you know, so it's a whole generation later. And it's almost like, well, why does that happen? And this is after he kills his daughter. Mm-hmm. So it's at least 2 months after his victory over the Ammonites, right? It is the Ammonites he's fighting.
Yes, yeah. It is.
So it's 2 months later. Then the men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed Zaphon and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over against the Ammonites and not go with us, not call us to go with you? I just find that really interesting. And I don't know that – I don't really know what that connection is. I just find it interesting that Ephraim, like – and this is if I'm not mistaken, it's the Ephraim that live on the other side of the Jordan.
I believe that's correct.
Because you have Reuben, is it Reuben, Ephraim, and half tribe of Manasseh that live on that side of the Jordan that said, like, hey, we'll just hang out here and we'll go with you to fight for you, and then we'll come back to our land once all of Israel is taken, like in Joshua. I'm not sure if that's
the answer, and it says here they crossed the Jordan, so yes.
Yeah, and so does Ephraim just have a chip on their shoulder when they're not called to cross anytime there's a conflict? Is that just like a generational, like we didn't choose to go into the promised land with the other Israelites? Mm-hmm. Why are you guys not, even mm-hmm. though the promised land is supposed to extend to the great river? Well, which I did learn that Solomon did rule all the territory to the great river.
Interesting.
Which is interesting to the Euphrates. Go ahead, Ben.
But I think in the Jephthah's response, he says, we did call you and you didn't answer.
That's right.
Which is also interesting. But this is a different thought, but I'm going to have to go in a minute. So I just wanted to say this because when I was reading it for myself, something knowing that this is like an unholy vow, like we talked about, you know, it's this interesting thing that happens, but it's not to be celebrated. It's not a blueprint for like, oh, you should also do this. Look how great Jephthah is because he stuck to his promise. In that, even though Jephthah is not celebrated, these days of mourning become a holiday or a ritual of some kind,
an observance,
to celebrate his daughter. And I think this is like occurred to me. Like I thought that was interesting that I was like, it does seem like his daughter seems like really noble, despite that she shouldn't have had to die. It's amazing that the way that this book portrays her. And I think it almost goes to what you were saying, Ben, of like this like foreshadowing of Jesus. And it even like fits into the layers of the stories that the book of Judges has already told, where, you know, Barak is intended to be a hero and he refuses the call. And so he's shown up by a woman, right? That this is, which, you know, within the context of the history at the time, right? Like men are supposed to be leaders, patriarchal society, what have you. And it is an insult to Barak that he's passed over for, you know, someone who is more outsider, you know, like has that more outsider status as a woman. And again, we see here where Jephthah is technically the leader, right? But it's not Jephthah that we remember, who we commemorate, who we celebrate. You know, it's not, we're not like, oh, good for Jephthah for making that vow and really sticking to it. It's not him that gets the honor of this. It's the daughter who says, I understand that this was a vow to God. I will give up my life so that you can keep your vow. That part that part is celebrated and only that part. I think that's interesting that it goes back to what you were saying, Ben, of like, it is self-sacrifice, not the demands to an angry God, not the like trying to bargain or buy favor in some way. It is the self-sacrifice that says, I will put my own, you know, like I will put my future in this case, you know, to the side and sacrifice myself. Gets some kind of like bigger mention.
And what's fascinating about her, to further connect to the Jesus story, what does it say she was? She was a virgin.
Yeah.
Right. Just like Mary.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's good. I'd kind of overlooked that part about you, that period of mourning. Does it say how long it was? Does it say the duration of that?
I think it said it was 4 days.
4 days every year. But she lamented for 2 months.
Which I, again, you know, if we're talking about numbers, like maybe those are references or call outs in some way, but I do think it's interesting that
she wandered in the wilderness like Jesus did, right?
True.
The 40-day fast, and then he was tempted by the devil.
Yeah. That's
there's a lot going on here.
I think that's pretty compelling. I think that stuck out to me right away, that I was like, interesting that like this tragedy, like this truly like a tragedy, became like a holiday, sort of, not like a holiday in the sense of like we celebrate it, but like in remembrance. What is that? I think, you know, Harrison asked this question while you're gone, Ben, of like, why are we elaborating on the stories we're elaborating? And I think if you like read it honestly and like look for like the context there, is Jephthah really celebrated as the hero? Not really. He's pitied. He's a tragic figure, but his daughter has made this impact that is remembered. And in some way it's almost like the only reason Jephthah is included is so we can explain this part of her history. You know, we do that 4 days of mourning. Here's why. It's this story. Remember her. Which is interesting. Anyways, I gotta step out, but it's great. Yeah. Great chatting with you guys.
All right. Love you, brother.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. And you know, following that, I hadn't realized that exact same conversation between Ephraim happened with Gideon, that it happens with Jephthah.
Yeah. Gideon diffuses and he's like, no, brothers, no. Like a ton of people, like civil war happens and 42,000 Ephraimites are killed.
Yeah. I guess again, that kind of speaking to this decline in quality of the judges.
Yeah. And an important thing is, like, according to the notes here, they were not significant in the history of Israel ever again.
Mm-hmm.
Like the hot-headedness of Ephraim and its men had massive implications for their tribe. I mean, and they do this through a, why have you come up to fight against me? And it's like, you're fugitives, blah, blah, blah. And so they go to basically the Gileadites, those under Jephthah, go to the fjord of the Jordan, or the fords, what am I? The fjords of Jordan. I didn't know Jordan had fjords. The fords of Jordan, which is where they would cross over. And basically they would do a test, a word test. They would have, would have them say Shibboleth. And when he could not pronounce it right, they seized him and slaughtered him. So it really wasn't even a fight. It was more of a slaughter, a massacre, basically an ethnic cleansing, if you will. We're going to kill all the Ephraimites. It's just highlighting the internal strife. And again, going what Ben was saying about Judges not being a book, like basically past Deborah and Gideon.
Yeah.
There's like no judge where you're like, I want to be like them. Right. It's like, yeah, I'll be like Deborah. Every little girl should want to be like Deborah. And every boy like loves the story of Gideon.
Yeah.
You know, and Shamgar, of course. But like, There's nothing here. I mean, even as you get into Samson, like there's nothing redeeming about Samson except that he was strong. And you know, he's been popped up by the great epic stories from Hollywood.
Yes.
you know, Samson versus Hercules, you know, you have these super brawny lumberjack American actors play Samson. And you have what we would consider today incredibly cheesy fight scenes. But I remember it. I remember him just wailing with the jawbone of a donkey in, you know, this 1960s film and just splitting Philistine heads open. And I was like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And there's a modern version. There's modern version of it. I think there was a recent, you know, TV show that you could stream about Samson. It was just as it's missing the points here that Samson is a tragedy, and you got to read these like you would read Greek tragedies.
Yep.
Like understanding this woman who loves Samson, Delilah, which we'll get to, I think, in a later episode.
Yes, we will.
Like did she love Samson? Or was she manipulating Samson? And that's a tragedy in its own right.
It is.
To be a man and being manipulated by a woman. But,
And I think with. Go ahead.
I was going to say, before we get to Samson, we've got these other minor judges, and we see that theme. He had 30 sons, 30 daughters, gave his in marriage outside of his clan. He judged Israel for 7 years. This is Ibzan. And then Elon, the Zebulonite, judged Israel, judged 10 years. He's died and was buried. And then after him is Abdon, son of Hillel. But he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys. So again, we see that theme of wealth. And the question is, like, what's the significance there? And there's probably, if you talk to a rabbi or an observant Jew, they'd probably be like, oh yeah, this is what that means. Is it incredibly significant for us today? I don't know. He's rich.
Yeah. I mean, I think to me, when I saw the number of children and the number of possessions, to me, it just spoke about it, to kind of transfer it to a modern reality. It just kind of speaks to this idea that, you know, the scene, S-E-E-N, the seen reality really is not that impactful. It's the unseen reality that is impactful. And so past what you could consider metrics of a successful person is depravity, is unrighteousness. Mm-hmm. To an extent. I mean, we don't have specific details about these particular judges, but when I was kind of reading through those, my mind was kind of already thinking about Samson, but this idea that, you know, they have these possessions, they have these things, and yet there's no highlighting obedience or living righteously or serving God or ministering in some capacity or building or constructing. It's all just describing these individuals and what they had. And, you know, again, this is speculation. This is kind of an outside scripture, but perhaps the reason is because that was it, right? That was their legacy, was just what they, what could be seen. In particular, like you said, the different judges there, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, I just wonder if, you know, that's mentioned there because that was what was worth mentioning, right? I mean, yes, this is an Old Testament scripture, but it's still God-breathed. It's still God-inspired, yeah. Right? As Timothy and talks also, about, scriptures used for different purposes, right? For instruction, mm-hmm. for training in righteousness. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there is substance in here. To me, what sticks out is this idea of it's not the seen is irrelevant. It's the unseen. And underneath this surface, you know, you have immediately after these judges, before Samson, the Israelites again did what was evil in the Lord's sight. Mm-hmm. And so the Lord handed them over for 40 years. They were under the Philistines' thumb.
And I think also with the Hebrews and the Jewish people, there's a big, big importance on genealogies and tracking history.
Yeah. Right.
So why would you have minor judges here? Well, because these are the men who judged Israel after Japheth. And we have to have a congruent account of history. is my thought. I mean, they could have given me more about Shamgar, but maybe Shamgar was just so famous. They were like, orally, the tradition will never die. And here we are.
When you when you get to heaven, that'll be your first question out of your mouth.
God, where's Shamgar? Where is he? Where, they'll be like, oh, Shamgar was more like Jephthah, and he really kind of didn't make it. And like, oh.
Yeah, got you.
He wasn't one of those. Anywho.
And so in chapter 13, this is the story of Samson. In this one, I'm going to sort of make a rather spontaneous decision. I'm just going to kind of briefly talk about this, but I want to save the substance for when we can discuss the full story of Samson.
Sure.
Is that all right, Harrison?
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm just going to give a little bit of kind of where I'm headed personally, directionally, with this. And then you can, if you want as well. So to me, kind of like Jephthah, as I was reading Samson, and just like Harrison, I cannot pronounce that guy's name. Jephthah. There we go. There it is.
I'm not convinced that's how you say it.
Yeah, I'm not convinced either. I'm pretty sure I saw Ben laughing under his breath there when he was trying to correct
it. It might be Jephthah.
There it is.
Is it a transliteration? PH.
Let's just call him Jeph.
Jeph. Good old Jeph.
Good old Jeph.
Evil, wicked Jeph.
And so wicked in guy. As I was reading through this, similar to with Samson, I kept on being struck by the similarities to Jesus and the points of similarity. So I'll just mention a few of these that I thought were fascinating. An angel comes to the mother and says, I'm going to give you a son. Yeah. Just like Gabriel does to, or is it Michael or Gabriel that comes to Mary? I think it's Gabriel. It's Gabriel, Gabriel. Yeah. Comes to Mary, says you're going to have a son.
If Michael visits you, you got a different problem.
That's right.
You're about
to
get smoked.
Yeah, now my archangel's messed up there. That's funny. Get smoked. Michael's actually about to upload a montage clip of all the of all the spiritual slangs he's done.
Slayed. It's like when Michael shows up, you get that guy, like when you get too many kills in Halo.
There you go.
That's like Killicide.
Kilimanjaro.
It's like when Michael slew, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah so much, it was just like racking up the cha-ching sound from there all the go. Dough. Cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. That's headshot.
Hilarious. High score. No, I'm just kidding.
Rampage.
And so there's not only that, right? An angel comes to visit the wife of Samson, just like it is with Jesus. Yet what do we also see? Both parents did as they ought. They raised him as they knew how. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are some errors in their parenting, but they, for the most part, they attempted to do as they ought. Both Samson and Jesus interacted with the Spirit of the Lord, obviously Jesus in a fuller capacity, and both were turned loose against the enemy. They both turned their conquest into something sweet. Samson issues this riddle forth. Again, Jesus often described as a sweetness, right? Taste and see that the Lord is good.
Yeah.
Both brought ruin upon the enemy. And
through sacrifice.
Yep, self-sacrifice. Samson, give me strength, pillars. Again, we'll explore that later. But the most important thing to me that stuck out, and I'll really speak on this next time, is there is a part where Samson carries the enemy's gates on his back. What does that remind us of?
Yeah. Right? Gates of hell shall not prevail.
Gates of hell shall not prevail on the revelation, on the knowledge of me. And so again, I think we just see this foreshadowing of a better judge, right? Oh, at least a coming judge, not one in his ministry on earth, but a coming judge, but also a coming savior, a coming person to rescue Israel and eventually the world. And so I just want to let that sort of sit in the ether leading up to next week.
Yeah, I find that, and I think it's important to just note that Jesus is the perfection of humanity. And so this whole time we've been talking about Samson's not a good dude and Samson's, you know, depraved and all that stuff. We're not saying that that's how Samson is like Jesus, or how Jesus is like Samson. You know, we see that theme that we talked about in episode 1 or episode 2, but like Jesus is as the second Adam, Adam the man, not Adam the particle, but the second Adam comes and is fulfilled in Jesus. So Jesus has this role of the perfect man that harkens back to an imperfect man.
Yep.
Right. And so I think it's perfectly justifiable to look at the text and to look for the similarities between characters and our Savior, and seeing like, oh, wow, that's very interesting that we have this. And because what that does is it creates a cohesiveness of the word.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, look at God writing here. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's like the person who wrote Judges didn't know about Jesus as far as we know.
Right.
You know, like, right. At least he wrote the book, the author of Judges, who I'm not even sure who the author of Judges is. What is going on? That is not, I was on the wrong thing. Okay, author of Judges. Let's see. Samuel. I knew that. That's like when you use a calculator to do 25 plus 25.
51.
So Samuel had not encountered Jesus, but Samuel was a prophet of God. So who's to say that as he's writing this, he's not doing so with what God has in mind, for, you know, through him. But what I really like here is I think her name's Hannah, Samson's mother.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
He says, hey, husband. Quote, a man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of an angel of God. Very awesome. I just like that line. I don't know how it says it in other scriptures, but in the Yoda Bible, which is the ESV, I like how she's a little
awe-inspiring. Awe-inspiring in the CSB. I like awesome. I like that more. That's cool.
Yo, husband. Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome. What a Saul. No, you didn't see it. We don't know which angel this was that came to Hannah to tell her because he doesn't give her his name.
Nope.
But it is very interesting, the covenant through which Samson is supposed to live and that he does live. And so we do get going back to the Jesus image, right, of like Jesus living a sinless life, like Samson, although he's a bit of a jerk and does what he wants, he abides by the covenantal requirements that brought about his birth.
Yes.
And the only time he fails in that is he tells the love of his life where his strength comes from.
Yep.
And so she cuts his hair, which is technically not saying like the covenant is not, and he shall tell no one.
You're right. Good point. Where
it's just, he's like, hey, yeah, Delilah, I love you. We're playing this fun game. Yeah, sure. It's my hair. And then she betrays him. The Philistines come out and cut his hair. And he's like, what have you done?
Yep.
But he abides by this covenant of the conditions of his conception. Jesus abides by the covenant of the conditions of his conception.
Yeah.
Well done. Conception, right. Also, what I find really interesting when we talk about Samson is the people that died under Samson were not only the, is it 800 or 1200? I can't remember. The jawbone of a donkey, 1,000 men. It was in between. Kills 1,000 men, right?
Yep.
But when he brings down the temple, which we'll get to, it's 3,000.
Yep.
3,000. And we're like, yeah, okay. Do you know how many Americans died in the trade centers in 9/11? 3,000. And it shaped the course of a nation of 3.5 million.
Great point.
Like, how many Jews just died in the October 7th attack? Over 1,000.
Oh, yeah.
Of a country of a few million, like 4 to 6 million.
Massive percentage.
Massive, much higher percentage. 3,000 I think, and I want to say I researched this once, and like the community was one of 30,000.
Yeah, especially in ancient times, you didn't have huge settlements.
Yeah, and obviously the Philistine people is larger than 30,000. Like they go to war with tens of thousands of men.
Yeah.
But this community, when I last did research, and again, I could be wrong, and I'll accept that, it's 30,000. So 3,000 at 30,000, 10% of their population gone. The earth-shattering nature of that, that's the equivalent of 3.5 million Americans gone. That's like a nuke hitting Dallas.
Yeah.
It's that level of calamity that God through Samson brings upon the Philistines. And because when we read about, 43,000 Ephraimites were killed that day earlier with the good old Jeff. And so it's just important to keep into context the weight of what Samson accomplished when he freed Israel. Like losing 10% of the population of that community removed any will of the Philistines to continue combat with the Israelites. And obviously we have lots of Philistine combat through David. Goliath was a Philistine, sons of Gath, like the Anak, they're all Philistines, they're all giants. And, so it doesn't end anything here, but it is startling. And we need to make sure that we're ingesting the history here with the right weight.
Yes.
So that's, if you were to give your taste of what you think about when you're reading the story of Samson, that would be mine. And that's just always captivated me, that the same number of people who died at 9/11 is who Samson killed when he brought down the pillars of the temple.
Yeah.
And how
interesting 9/11 connection.
Just changed the entire trajectory of this nation. Mm-hmm. Like flags. I mean, I remember that commercial. There was like and on 9/11, terrorists wanted to change America forever. And like it's a street, an image of a street, and the screen goes black and it comes back up and there's American flags flying at every house. And they succeeded or something like that. And it's this element of it's this element of like pride and arrogance. And, there's we can unpack that whole spiritually Jacob Kahn or whatever, the harbingers anyway. But the weight of what God did through Samson is arguably it's not the most people that have died, but it's the largest feat that we've maybe seen of a judge in the whole story. And that's why Samson's so popular. And did Deborah and Barak, they killed more men, tens of thousands of men.
Oh yeah.
Much greater loss of life and calamity, but there's something about the Samson story and the way that happens that just devastates the community. And so it's important for us to think about.
Yeah. Again, it's like that idea of we're talking about with these judges after Jephthah is, it's not so much the seen, but the unseen, that action shifted something in the spiritual, in the supernatural, and the sort of the dispositional affective nature around the Philistines.
Yeah.
We want to, want to thank you guys for joining us on this episode 6 of Unscripted Study, where we ended up doing Judges 10 through 12. We'll pick up with the rest of the Samson story. We'll see you in 2 weeks. So two weeks from not today, but 2 weeks from yesterday. Our normal upload day is Wednesday evening. This has been Unscripted Study. I'm Benjamin Rollins, Harrison Cohn, and Benjamin Battles, where the words may be ancient, but the conversation is fresh and ever evolving. Stay tuned, subscribe, and follow us on your preferred platform, and we'll let the unscripted exploration continue. God bless.